Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Garnet Health is teaming up with Montefiore Health System. But what does that mean for patients and local services? CEO of Garnet Health Catskills, Jerry Dunleavy, joins us to explain the affiliation and how he says it could strengthen care in Sullivan and Orange counties. Plus, local economic perspective from James B. Huntington. Our friend Les Christ stops by with some community events that are upcoming and how you can get involved. And the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance serves up diner stories this weekend in Narrowsburg. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi sits down with the co-directors to talk about what's on the menu. Those stories coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump is now in Japan, where he is scheduled to meet the country's newly installed prime minister. He has already met with Japanese Emperor Naruhito. Trump is focusing on trade this trip. His next destination is South Korea. There, he's expected to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent is traveling with the president. Bessent says negotiators for the U.S. and China have made progress on trade talks.
We have a framework for President Trump, President Xi, to decide on, and we discussed a wide range of things from tariffs, trade, fentanyl, substantial purchase of U.S. agricultural products.
And rare earths.
But the Treasury Secretary says nothing is final until Trump and Xi meet on Thursday. The federal government shutdown is nearly 4 weeks old. The largest union of federal workers is today calling on lawmakers to pass a spending bill and reopen the federal government. Hurricane Melissa is now a Category 5 storm that's expected to move over Jamaica as soon as tonight. NPR's Nathan Rott reports the island and other countries in the Caribbean are bracing for catastrophic flooding.
30 inches of rain are expected in some parts of the Caribbean over the coming days, creating life-threatening and catastrophic conditions, the National Hurricane Center warns. Flash floods and debris flows or mudslides are expected. Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Cuba are also being affected, but the immediate forecast warns the slow-moving storm will move close to or directly over Jamaica in the coming days. The U.S. Navy began evacuating personnel from Guantanamo Bay in Cuba over the weekend. Nate Rott, NPR News.
The search for bodies of the remaining Israeli hostages continues in Gaza. There are also reports of the Israeli military striking Palestinians inside the enclave. NPR's Rob Schmitz reports from Tel Aviv this could threaten the two-week-old ceasefire.
Over the weekend, Israel allowed a search and rescue team from Egypt to enter Gaza to search for the bodies of the 13 remaining hostages. According to an official who spoke to NPR but not authorized to speak publicly about the matter, Israel also allowed members of Hamas to cross the so-called yellow line into Israeli-held territory to assist in the search for the deceased hostages. Gaza's civil defense reports that Israel's military struck a group of Palestinian civilians who had returned to their homes near Khan Yunis in southern Gaza, killing two and injuring three. Over the weekend, Israel's military said it carried out a targeted strike in central Gaza on a member of the Islamic Jihad militant group, injuring four people in a car. Both attacks appear to be testing the U.S.-brokered ceasefire agreement. Rob Schmitz, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up nearly 300 points. This is NPR. California Governor Gavin Newsom says he will consider running for the Democratic presidential nomination, but he says he will consider that after the midterm elections in 2026. Newsom spoke with CBS Sunday morning. As families in the U.S. and around the world have fewer children, economists say the trend is reshaping parts of the global economy. As NPR's Brian Mann reports, in many places, populations are aging fast and beginning to decline.
Most experts agree the shift to fewer kids is being driven by good things, including education and economic gains for women and plummeting teen pregnancy rates. But there are also challenges. Economists say families in all the countries that drive global GDP, from China to Germany to the U.S., are now having too few children to maintain a stable population and robust workforce. Lant Pritchett is at the London School of Economics.
It's hard to maintain the dynamism of the economy. You can't get people to do all kinds of work, from electricians to plumbers to everything else.
Many experts say the trend toward fewer children in the U.S. and around the world will continue, a pattern that's already straining pension and healthcare systems in some countries as populations age and shrink. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The U.S. Navy is investigating after losing two aircraft in the South China Sea. Both were based on the aircraft carrier the USS Nimitz. A fighter jet and a helicopter went down into the ocean in separate circumstances. These occurred within a half hour of each other. All the crew were rescued. The Nimitz is returning to its home base in Washington State. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Garnet Health is taking a major step toward a new partnership it says will strengthen local health care. On October 15th, the hospital system signed a letter of intent to affiliate with Montefiore Health System. Garnet said when finalized, the new affiliation is anticipated to result in enhanced access to high-quality care, strengthened and expanded clinical services, and broaden access to specialty care for more than 500,000 residents served by Garnet Health throughout Orange and Sullivan counties and surrounding areas. I spoke with Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills CEO Jerry Dunleavy to explain why the affiliation is needed, what it means for patients and staff, and how it could shape the future of healthcare in Sullivan and Orange counties.
So, you know, Tim, if you look at what's happened around us, you know, really what's happened across the country, most smaller hospitals have already aligned with larger health systems. So the smaller health systems and the smaller hospitals standing alone is becoming less and less of a factor. You know, for Garnet Health, despite the fact that we have a very strong market share, we are operating within a very, very challenging healthcare market. You know, some of the core challenges that we face, as well as other hospitals. Number one is a rising labor cost. You couple that with an increased supply cost, things like pharmaceuticals, energy acquisition, whether it's electricity or gas. And then general inflation was very, very challenging. And then, you know, there's the issue of reimbursement, and where reimbursement has been, in some cases, declining or stagnant. And we can point to a couple of reasons why. One would be the aging population. And we've known this is coming, you know, been coming for some time with the baby boomer part of our population. So the aging population, however, that results in a transition from somebody that's working, has commercial insurance, which generally has favorable rates, transitioning to Medicare, which does not have the same rate of reimbursement as commercial care. So, you know, affiliating with a larger system is going to offer numerous benefits that are going to evolve over time. Early on in the relationship, we can see, you know, things like shared services, corporate services, if you will, that can stretch across the entire system and perhaps provide some economies of scale. It could be in the area of information technology. It could be finance, human resources and benefits management, and then procurement. It also offers the potential for better negotiating power. You know, that every hospital, every health system has numerous contracts that they're negotiating on a regular basis. So having a little bit stronger negotiating power would be very, very helpful. And then the other factor is that, you know, Montefiore offers really tertiary clinical expertise that will help us further develop, grow, and expand our service lines. And, you know, a great example of that would be in cardiology, in our cardiac surgery program at the Middletown campus. We, as recently as, I believe it was Wednesday, We had the senior surgeon from the Montefiore Health System in our hospital meeting with our cardiology team, our physicians, our nurses, to talk about what it takes to deliver a quality program. And I think having Montefiore as our partner in that area and many others will result in what we all want, which is access to care, but more importantly, access to high quality care.
And this is an affiliation, not a merger, not an acquisition. How is an affiliation different from other healthcare system partnerships, for example?
Great question, Tim. So let me start by saying this. I think it's important to note, and for our community to understand, that Garnet Health initiated this process. We were the ones who decided to seek out a partner to make us a stronger organization for the local community. This process started with, I believe it was about 18 different health systems that we looked at and evaluated, and some of them fell off the list pretty quickly. And then ultimately, through a process that took a little over a year, we were able to narrow it down to three different health systems. So now, just to get to your question, the terms merger, acquire, and things like purchase are sometimes incorrectly used as if they're synonymous with an affiliation. And that's not the case. And I think one of the things that I'm grateful to have the opportunity to talk with you today is that, these terms, they can confuse the public. And if you're not familiar with them or familiar with healthcare, that's important to clear up. So just to be clear, there's been no sale, there's been no purchase of our organization or of our assets. And to be honest with you, this is common in states that allow private ownership of hospitals. And that has proven to be very risky. And we've seen in some states, for example, in Pennsylvania, I believe in the past year and a half, there were four hospitals that were owned by private ownership that ultimately closed. And, that's just not something that would happen in New York State. So healthcare in New York State is very highly regulated. And some of that regulation protects our community from that type of an exposure. So, an affiliation is mutually beneficial in a couple of ways. Number one, the new affiliate benefits from the resources of a larger system. And that's what I referred to earlier as those shared services. The community benefits from our improved ability, to maintain and to grow services and potentially bring back some services that have closed or have shrunk in size in recent years because of financial pressure. And then for the larger system, it becomes more readily available to patients and physicians in our community, and it allows for the transition of care for those that need those tertiary or quaternary level of care services that are only offered in academic centers. So, this isn't a model that's, designed on trying to figure out how do we take patients from our community and send them to a hospital in the city. That is not the plan here. The plan, which is mutually agreed upon by Montefiore and us, is that wherever we can, we want to provide care locally, have easy access to care, easy access to follow-up, and then where there are cases that we just don't do locally, to have an affiliate that can provide that seamless access is just fantastic, I think, for everybody, both in Sullivan and in Orange County.
When we spoke in July, you talked about how rural hospitals are navigating federal Medicaid cuts, specifically concerns about rural older populations relying on Medicaid and about a reduction in state appropriations to rural hospitals. Does this affiliation alleviate some of those concerns?
I think the fair and honest question to that is in some ways yes, and in some ways no. So, what we discussed over the summer is still true today. It's really not clear what's going to happen at the state level with regard to closing the gap with the loss of federal funding. You know, the question is there going to be availability of any state reserve funds to support hospitals? Will the safety net funding still be available? And, you know, how will that help hospitals make it through navigating these, especially these early years? And as I mentioned back in July, you know, the real impact will be seen in late 2026 when these cuts go into effect. You know, safety net funding, such as, you know, the safety net transformation grant that we've been looking at lately, it requires Garnet to submit an application with a partner. We feel that Montefiore would be an excellent partner. They are one of the highest volume providers of Medicaid patients. They also have, you know, a really strong history of successful safety net and safety net transformation grants. So we look forward to being able to partner with them on a grant that we would be partners on. You know, every hospital, every health system, both large and small, is going to be impacted by these cuts. The affiliation doesn't alleviate those concerns, but it does offer opportunity really for us to improve operations in other areas that could help offset some of the loss from the Medicaid cuts.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jerry Dunleavy, CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills, about the affiliation proposed between Garnet Health and Montefiore Health System. Mr. Dunleavy, we've heard from some residents that are concerned this affiliation will affect staffing and services. You alluded to this earlier about services that could be improved, but what changes can patients and even employees expect?
Yeah, that's, you know, I certainly, and look, I'm a member of the community as well. So, you know, I would be concerned about that. But I think if I can share with you a little bit about the process that we went through, and then just a reminder, you know, Garnet Health's board and Garnet Health's executive team is and many of our management team is made up of members of the community. So, you know, as part of the process throughout our initial negotiations, the board made it clear to all of our potential partners as we were vetting the right partner, what we called preference items. And it was things that the board and the community members of the board felt that we needed to say, this is important to us, this needs to be part of our deal. And I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one is a commitment to rural health. And what that means is our Harris campus and our Calicoon campus need to stay viable. We need to be able to provide services in those areas. Things like behavioral health, OBGYN, so obstetrics and gynecology, cardiac services, including our cardiac surgery program. These were important services that we wanted to have assurances were going to continue in the community. And that is part of both the letter of intent and then ultimately our final agreement. These things will stay a part of the agreement. But it goes even a little bit further. There's definitely a shared vision on the need for a replacement hospital in Sullivan County. So that's something that we've been pursuing. And we've applied for a couple of grants that we have not been awarded. But again, having a partner being a larger health system, we think that we might be able to finally, you know, get this one over the goal line. Physician recruitment, both in primary care and specialty care, was one of our preference items. And again, one that the Montefiore Health System agreed to. You know, as I said, all of these are in the initial letter, and they will flow through to the final agreement.
You've signed a letter of intent to pursue an affiliation with Montefiore Health System. What are the next steps in the timeline?
Yeah, there's really three very important steps. And the first one you mentioned, which we've already completed, which is that letter of intent. And that was executed on Wednesday of last week. The next part would be what's called a definitive agreement. And the definitive agreement further defines all of the terms and conditions of the affiliation. It involves a lot of due diligence. And you know, basically what that is confirming that for Garnet Health, we are who we say we are. So that's a process that's likely take somewhere around 45 days or so. But certainly we'd like to see that conclude by the end of 2025. And then after the definitive agreement is finalized, we're going to go through a period of time of regulatory approval. And that could take anywhere from 12 to 24 months. And the approval has to happen at two levels. The first is at the state level. That would be through the New York State Department of Health. And, you know, the good news there is Garnet Health meets with senior leaders in the Department of Health on a quarterly basis, updates them on what's happening in our organization. And in recent our recent meetings, we brought up the process of affiliation. So, you know, this is not going to be a surprise to the state and one that we anticipate going through rather smoothly at the state level. At the federal level, there's the Federal Trade Commission, and that's really the process that could potentially take the longest, but we're confident that we're in a good position to get both state and federal approval.
I just want to ask you about federal government. The government is entering its fourth week of a shutdown. Are there any immediate impacts to Garnet Health due to the shutdown and any potential long-term impacts?
Well, you know, the good news there is we have not seen any significant impact as of today. You know, one of the things that we would, of course, worry about, an organization that operates on a very, very thin margin and has a high percentage of Medicare patients, you know, we were concerned, you know, what's going to happen with our Medicare claims? Are they going to be processed in a timely manner? And so far, everything's good there. We, like many people, are watching closely on how things are evolving in Washington. So the good news is not a lot of problems right now, but we are, of course, hopeful, as many other people are, that we can resolve this soon.
Before we go, what would you like folks to know about the future of Garnet Health in our region?
Yeah, Tim, I think that I hope that everyone understands that this is a great opportunity for our community, for both Sullivan County, Orange County, and also some of the surrounding counties that we serve, like Ulster County and Pike. There are portions of that community that seek care with us. You know, the affiliation offers several short-term and long-term benefits. It will, as I've said, and this is a little bit of a summary, it strengthens and preserves our current services. It grows and perhaps restores some services, and it really positions our system for sustainability and a long-term ability to deliver healthcare, to deliver exceptional healthcare to the community. You know, our board and our leadership team is committed to open, honest, and transparent communication throughout this process. I look forward to continued conversations like this one today as we work through the process and keep the community informed. And I said it earlier, but I think it bears value in repeating. Our board consists of members of the community, and they represent Sullivan County and Orange County. The board was instrumental in ensuring that any affiliation preserved a lot of what is unique to Garnet Health, and that ensuring that it allows us to meet the needs of the community. You know, the same is true of our leadership team. We live here. We want great health care for our community and for our families. And I think this is a big step in ensuring our ability to provide care both now and into the future.
Jerry Dunleavy, CEO of Garnet Health Medical Center Catskills. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much, Tim. Have a great day.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. This is Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. Early voting is happening now in New York State and goes through November 2nd. All registered voters in Sullivan County are eligible to cast an early vote at one of two locations in Monticello and Liberty. Find your New York early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. That's elections.ny.gov. Election day is November 4th. This is Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, soccer leagues around the world use a promotion and relegation system to reward the best teams and punish the worst.
It's great for fans of teams outside the major leagues. It's fantastic for competitive balance.
So, would American fans benefit if the best college teams could make it to the pros? That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday afternoon at 2 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and happy Monday. Working 9 to 5. That means it's time to hear from James B. Huntington, local economist and author, for some local economic perspective. James B., thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's get into it. What happened with inflation in September?
Well, it crept up again. It was 3% from a year earlier. That's up from 2.9% rather the previous month. That's based on the consumer price index. It's the fastest since the start of the year. It marks only a small rise from the previous month, though. Core inflation, which takes out energy and food prices, was also 3.1%. Or 3.0%, rather, stayed the same. So, not a big change on inflation.
So, not a big change in inflation, but some folks are calling this economy a casino economy. What does that mean?
Well, it means that there is gambling throughout, one end to the other, an unusual amount before. We have the tech giants spending billions on AI data centers and on power. We have a government shutdown with two sides sort of almost playing chicken with each other over healthcare things. We have tariffs being used as bargaining chips to shrink the trade deficit and whatever else our president has in mind. We have erratic treatment of the U.S. dollar. We have Bitcoin and Ether and other cryptocurrencies being used even by large financial institutions as loan collateral. We have venture capital funding companies that let people bet against their bills, and we have a bunch of bad loans coming from regional banks. So just from one end to the other, there's a lot of people taking chances, and that means all the chances may not come in as they hope they will.
Because in a casino, the odds are stacked against you. Usually the house wins, right?
Oh, yes, yes. Over the long run, that's how they make their money.
Let's talk about some of the practical things that are going on when it comes to the economy. Let's talk about retirement accounts. How should folks be prioritizing withdrawals from retirement accounts as, you know, you look toward the year end here?
A lot of people are coming up on required minimum distributions. That's going to be starting at age 73 for people now. It'll go up to 75 for people born in 1960 or later. So we have the general priority we should be happening is first from brokerage accounts, second from tax-deferred accounts, and then from tax-free accounts. That's the general order you should be withdrawing things. But to a great extent, you should be planning and figuring out when these required withdrawals and other withdrawals are going to affect you, because a lot of them have tax consequences when the money is withdrawn. Both of them do. So you'll want to make sure that your tax burden isn't so high. Don't withdraw a lot of things in 1 year. Spread them out to the extent you can. Look at your tax brackets. It may make a big difference instead of withdrawing everything in 1 year, where you could get hit quite hard if you have a lot of money. Spread it out in a lot of things. So mainly you have to look over what you have and what you plan on doing with approximations, and see what the tax bill is, based, of course, on whether you're itemizing or whether you're filing jointly or separately or you're single. And check these things out, because there could be different things, and you stand to risk a lot of money or lose money by not doing them in orders that are most optimal.
Now, the Fed is going to meet Wednesday for another interest rate decision. What do we think might happen? And then how might that affect folks when it comes to, you know, their money and their savings?
It's a big favorite that the Fed is going to have a 0.25% interest rate cut this week. Wednesday was the day they'll be meeting and announcing it's over 95%, so no one is acting like there's any doubt. So that means rates may go down for savings accounts and CDs. So the banks and credit unions and such are not charging lower rates now. They're going to wait till interest rates actually go into effect. So your thing can do, if you're thinking about starting a CD, if you're in good position to not need that money for a length of time and get the much higher generally interest rates than savings accounts pay, then do that today or tomorrow and get everything going, get everything in place before the thing hits on Wednesday.
And we've got some updates on some fun things you've got always for us. The world's first flying car. What is that? How does it work? And what's happening with it?
They're hawking it in Fox News as being the first flying car. I know there have been others, but this may be the first one that's actually available or will be available very soon. And you can buy it, and you're allowed under some circumstances to ride it. It's made by a company called Alef, A-L-E-F, and it is, the first one is a Model Zero Ultralight. So you're allowed to fly these things when there are circumstances under which you don't even need pilot's license to run these things. If you fly under a low area, a low altitude, that you're not going to have the same rules as would be for flying a Cessna or some normal private plane. So some of the rules you'll have is that they can only fly under certain routes. You, I think, will find out from the FAA what they are, only during the daylight and nothing over crowded areas or cities. So you can fly it over countryside from near one city to near another and then switch over to driving. So we're looking at something like about $300,000.
Oh, wow.
These will cost.
I was going to put it on my Christmas list, but maybe not with that price tag. Let's talk about the all-time record a certain American manufacturer has recently reached.
Yes, here you go. You asked for it. Here it is. The record is by Charmin, and they have unveiled its new product. It is a toilet paper roll that stretches as high as the Washington Monument. It has been rolled out nationwide. It's supposed to last up to a month. It has 32 times more sheets than a standard roll. And the company said, they actually said this, less swapping, more going.
Always so bringing us some good news.
You can get them, yes. They also say that changing the role all the time is a big pain in the butt.
Oh, boy. So, solving problems we didn't know we had.
You can get them at Walmart, Target, and Amazon, and it's called the Charmin Forever Role.
Forever.
American ingenuity.
At its best. All right, let's talk about the numbers. What were the stock, oil, and precious metal prices this morning? How did they change?
Okay, over the past week, and these are based on 5-something this morning where they were at, gold, 40.39, that's down 216. Finally, the profit-taking week I'd been expecting for a long time. Silver, 47.81, down $4.04. Same sort of idea, ratio of silver to gold is 84.5 to 1. The Dow Jones Industrial Average, 47,207, up over 1,000. More all-time highs, probably reinforced by people moving money over from gold and other precious metals. NASDAQ, 23,205, up 525. Same general idea, all-time highs there, too. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, $60.91 per barrel. That's up $3.77. It almost neutralized last month's gain, but it's still, or last month's loss, rather. It's a gain for consumers, so I think of low as being good with this. So it looks like we're still doing well in general. Bitcoin, 115,175, up just short of 4,000. That's 1/3 of last week's loss, the way it goes. British pound, 1.3331, down 0.85 of a cent. U.S. dollar is stronger for now, but as interest rates come in and they're lower and such, it may be the British pound may go up. Much the same for the euro, but milder, 1.1631, down 0.31 of a cent. It did better, relatively. And the Japanese 100 yen coin, 65 cents down a penny, weakening, but not all that different from where it's been. So overall, don't worry about the metals. They're way up, and they're going to go up more. It's been overdue. So much of them, the investors who offer them are conscious of prices and are willing to take profits, but they'll go up. In fact, gold has already rebounded. It was about 4,000 even, so it's rebounded about $40 an ounce since the worst profit-taking day happened. So expect no change in general on these things from the interest rate decision if it's as we expect.
All righty. Keeping an eye on it. For us, James B. Huntington, local economist and author, joins us every Monday. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, our good friend Les Christ is here with some community events and how you can get involved. You're listening to Radio Chatskill.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. This Friday's show falls on Halloween. You know what that means. Goth Dance Party. Favorites from the likes of The Cure, Susie and the Banshees, and Love and Rockets, along with subterranean tracks creeping up from the underworld. 7 p.m. Friday night, Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Well, every once in a while, we get to have the pleasure of our friend Les Christ stopping by the studios from Chris Kelly Office Systems, but also a community leader and a man about town. Hello.
Hello. How are you, Tim? Good morning.
Good morning. And you've got a list of things you want to talk about
today. Absolutely. Some kinds of stuff that'll be going on.
Community events and how folks can get involved. What do you got first on your list there?
Okay. Let's talk about the Monticello Rotary Club and Rotary in general, if you will.
The good work they're doing. Yeah.
There's a number of different things that have been going on. First, let me tell you about one or two programs. One that we already had about 2 weeks ago. Domingo Ramos. I don't know if everybody knows who Domingo is, but Hope Alive, 845. Mm-hmm. He goes out and he finds lost or kidnapped or runaway children, mm-hmm, and adults. And Domingo is just fabulous. I think he said in this year so far that they have found 69 out of 72 missing people. and he works with all the different law enforcement agencies in Sullivan County, and he saves lives. He really does, and he just makes a difference in the world. So that was a fabulous program, but I wanted everybody to be aware that it exists.
Yeah.
Because if somebody's lost, get in touch with Domingo immediately. Do not wait a day. Immediately try to get in touch with Hope Alive 845. Next program we're going to have is a little happier one than that. John, on November 11th, which is Veterans Day, John Conway, our Sullivan County historian, will be in to the Monticello Rotary, which meets in Monticello, of course, and every Tuesday, every single Tuesday. And John is going to be talking about Veterans Day and the history of Veterans Day in Sullivan County. Next, I want to talk about the Monticello Rotary food drive that's taking place on November 22nd. That is the Saturday right before
Thanksgiving
Day, yeah. Of course, and it's going to take place at ShopRite in Monticello. And right now, food is really well needed everywhere in the country. Certainly in Sullivan County, we have a need for collecting food. The food that we collect is going to go directly to the Sullivan County Federation for the Homeless and to the United Way, and is going to be given out to anybody that needs it in Monticello and that area and the rest of Sullivan County. And we're going to have many, many turkeys, as we usually do, probably as many as 50 or more turkeys that we'll be able to give out, non-perishable foods and so forth. So please, if you see the Rotarians by ShopRite in Monticello, November 22nd, help us out, please. We try to help the entire county. All right, then we're going to move slightly away from the Rotary talk, and we're going to talk next about Murph's Toy Drive.
There's
okay?
a toy drive, yeah.
Murph's Toy Drive, and that's going to take place on December 6th at the Villa Roma Clubhouse. But it's beyond just having a party. It's collecting toys, and the toys are distributed again by United Way, by Julian Dawson, who's absolutely, absolutely fabulous in distributing this stuff. It only goes to young people in Sullivan County, and it's distributed by Julian to every single school district in Sullivan County. And that night we'll have 300 people there. It's generally gets sold out about 2 or 3 weeks previous to the event. Fabulous event. We have a number of great dance bands that are going to be there. Paul Sorberto will be the host and the MC that night. We will have a wonderful evening. But the best part about the evening is we're going to collect, I'm going to say, 2,500 toys.
Wow.
That will all be given out to the young people only in Sullivan County.
Wow.
All right, and perhaps for right now, the last thing I'll talk about is not going to take place till February 20th, but we're preparing right now for the Heartathon.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the WSUL 98.3 Heartathon that's going to again take place on February 20th at the Resorts World Catskills. That's a Friday. And this year we have it's going to be just dynamite. We have fabulous co-chairs this year. Dr. David Potash is going to be one of the
SUNY Sullivan.
He was just installed as the new president of SUNY Sullivan. He is going to be one of our co-chairs. And the other co-chair is going to be George Kinney, who's the president of the Jeff Bank. So that is just going to be a very, very exciting day. And there's a good reason that we have the Heartathon, and that is to raise money and awareness for a number of community providers for the community. The main provider that we give money to is Garnett in Sullivan County, and the money just goes to Garnett in Sullivan County. Some of it goes to Harris. Some of it goes to Calicoon. But in past years, we've had heart monitors that we give to. We have exercise equipment that heart patients go on and really get better. Besides Garnett, in Sullivan County, we give some money to a single bite. We give money to Sullivan 180. We give money to the Steam Fund and to NAMI, all of which do amazing, incredible, fabulous programs for heart health and to get a better heart. Make your heart better either by better diet or knowledge about exercise or by treatment. So some great stuff coming up in the next number of months. And I thank you, Tim, for letting me. I talked as fast as I could. I really
you got
did.
It all in. It's okay. A busy time for you. Thank you for all the help that you do and provide
welcome,
for everybody
sir.
In the community. We appreciate it. Let's Chris.
Absolutely.
From Chris Kelly Office Systems. I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.
All right, now this weekend, the Delaware Valley Arts Alliance presents Diner Stories at the Tustin Theater in Narrowsburg. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with co-directors Eric Feinblatt and Caroline Bally about how Diner Stories brings community voices to the stage.
Good morning, and welcome to this segment of Radio Chatskill. And today we're very lucky to have Eric Feinblatt and Caroline Bailey. They've been here before because they're very active community members, especially in the art scene. And they have produced Diner Stories, and that'll be Saturday, November 1st, and Sunday, November 2nd. Saturday at 7 and Sunday at 2. Now, this play has an interesting history. So it's based on a play that some of us have seen when you had a playwrights competition about a year ago, correct?
Exactly.
So tell us about Diner Stories.
One of the plays in the On Belonging project, which was what you were referring to, was a short play called Diner, written by Tiffany Esteb. The Diner was a play that was basically a short, very frenetic, surrealistic play about the daily working life of three waitresses. And one of the waitresses happened to have been an El Salvadorian immigrant. We thought that these characters were really, really interesting, but wanted to explore their backstories, not only the backstories of the waitresses, but the owner of the diner. So this play is derived or inspired by the backstories of those characters. And Caroline can explain a little bit about how we went about delving into those backstories, developing them.
Caroline?
Yes, thank you. So one of the ways in which we direct and create really live theater, really sort of poignant theater, is to develop characters in great depth. And one of the things that we wanted to do was to get the voice of the communities. In fact, one of the aims of this program was, in fact, to use the theater as a tool to then actually have a platform to speak with communities about this topic. Even more so than the other way around, rather than sort of bolstering the theatre. We felt that we were using the theatre as a tool for communication with communities. So we spent time with different people that would come in and speak with us, experts from different organisations or experience working in the school system or social work system who have exposure to a lot of people who have these kinds of issues as migrants. And we also had workshops in different locations. We had one in the Black Library in Monticello and others. And in each of them, we put forward scenarios which then the audience would comment on and say, you know, whether they thought the characters were believable, whether the storyline was believable. And we've done this at different stages. So right from the early days when we were co-creating the play and actually co-writing it through improvisation and through the actors and directors and also Tiffany's input, we would collaborate and then we would share this with the communities, with these experts and get their input. And then we would make adjustments or we would put their stories in and the whole kind of piece then came together.
Right. It really was a process of improvisation and storytelling and feedback and revision and more improvisation and more storytelling. So it was really a long iterative process. Then we finally came up with what we call a devised script that all of us, all of we, the actors and the directors, participated in, as well as the community in helping us develop the script.
Now, when you say members of the community, that they weren't all professionals dealing with this issue.
None of them were professional. Okay. Professionals in some of the things that they did, social worker for the school system, a young woman who started an organization called Defensa Frontera that deals with immigrant issues. Community members, right?
And you had a range of community members.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So at the Black Library, for example, we had people that just wanted to come in and see what we were doing. And we had some really great feedback, and feedback that we didn't necessarily expect, for example, about what it was like to work in a diner. People that would, nobody would do that. They wouldn't do that. They wouldn't say that to their boss. They'd be in too much of a vulnerable position. Whatever it was, they had experience of that sort of frenetic work, that vulnerable work, and so on. So it wasn't necessarily the migrant issues. It was the other issues as well of what it is to work in that very fragile existence where you're dependent upon the tips and so on.
Right. Precarious work was an important part of what we're exploring in this, as well as the dynamics of an immigrant kind of entering into what seems to be a very stable environment and how the whole thing tends to fall apart in this case.
Now, Eric, you have some background in theater of the oppressed.
Right.
Correct?
Yeah.
That goes back to the 70s.
That does go back to the 70s.
Yes. Well, I remember it too.
Okay.
Okay.
Good.
The era of liberation theology.
Very much a part of what was percolating in South America at the time.
Yes.
It's something that both Caroline and I use often to develop the pieces and to seek out the authenticity of the pieces. So what we will do is, it's really based on a different relationship with the spectators, who are no longer called spectators but actors, where we invite them to comment on what is going on and where they see the action actually revealing experiences that ring true to them, and ask them somehow to either participate as actors or direct the actors in a way that would make the piece more realistic for them, I would say. So we use a lot of techniques. We use something called Cop in the Head, which is something that Boal, who is the originator of Theater of the Oppressed, it's another technique where we'll have an audience member stand behind an actor, and as the actor repeats some lines, the audience member will say very loudly what they think the actor really wants to say, not necessarily what they're saying or what they're trying to get across. So it's a very participatory way of fashioning a theater piece.
I remember being at one of those community events when you did Half Life.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting to observe.
Caroline, why don't you talk about what we did at Art Walk? Because that's where we used this technique more recently.
Sure. Using that approach, that exact approach, which we had the two characters of one of the waiters is not particularly happy that this person has arrived as an immigrant and working with them in the diner. And so we had a conversation between the two of them. We had an improvised conversation between the two of them. And then audience members would stand behind each one of them and say what they were really feeling. Because obviously in the case of our El Salvadorian waitress, she couldn't really say what she really wanted to somebody who she felt had a lot of power over her. So we could play around with those power relations. And what was really interesting was when I suggested giving her the power, actually one of the audience members suggested swapping the roles over. And she was far more dominant and powerful even than her actress colleague had been when they swapped roles. So, yeah, it's a very interesting technique. It's not the only thing that we do. I mean, we draw on lots of different theatre traditions. I work with many different types of organizations over the years. Eric and I had a theater past, so separate from each other, and then we conjoined our approaches when we met about 20 years ago, but each of us had a long history before that. And I had worked a lot with vulnerable, particularly women, women of domestic who'd experienced domestic abuse, or young teenage girls who just had children, or homeless populations. And in each of these cases, working with those communities and actually creating theatre either about their situations or with them, it actually empowers the people a lot, because they would say to you, you know, they might say, well, the actor should do this, the actor should do that. And they find themselves in a position of some knowledge and superiority, and they're not used to being treated in that way. They're not used to feeling like they have the knowledge and experience. And it's very empowering. We have a lot of those communities will come along to see the shows and find their ideas expressed on stage and feel like they've been listened to and heard in a very different way.
Yes, and I think that goes a little bit with your standing people together.
It does. Standing People Together is an offshoot or a program of our larger organization, which is called Waste for Life, just basically the mother organization. And Standing People Together is something that we started when we moved here. And we work, we explore a lot of social issues, and we work a lot we often use the environment to explore those issues. So we've done a lot of work with kids and with schools, running forest school sessions and training teachers in the public school system. But we're also very, very involved in art, different art projects, and those art projects are always take their cue from social issues that resonate with us and with the community.
And relating to that, I noted that you will have a talk back after Dinah Stories.
We will. We're going to have a little panel. It's going to be facilitated by Angela Dayutu from Rural Migrant Ministries. It'll be composed of it'll just be Angela and Caroline and myself, I think, on the panel. And we will be talking about the play and fielding questions. We think that the issues in the play will reverberate very well amongst the audience. And we expect there'll be lots of questions and a desire to discuss what they've just experienced.
Well, it sounds like it'll be a dynamic event.
We hope so.
And Eric, can you tell us who'll be performing in Dinah Stories?
Sure. We have four actors, Cass Collins, Nick Lopez, Aaron Gilmore, and Sam Melman. Three of them we've worked with quite a bit in the past, Cass, Nick, and Aaron. And Sam is new to us and just a wonderful young actress. All of our work has been supported recently, not just by DVAA, but also by Sullivan 180 through community development grants. And this is always something that's really particularly meaningful to us, that we get grants from two different organizations that have two different focuses or foci. I'm not sure which is correct. One arts-oriented, which is the DVAA, and the other community-oriented in very specific ways, which is Sullivan 180. And they saw both of those things coalesce in this project. And that is very heartwarming to us, that they recognize what we're doing.
They can see the intersection.
Right.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for taking the time to share all of this information with us.
Well, thank you again. It's always wonderful to be here with you.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You are welcome.
And thanks to culture reporter Valerie Banzi. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskills Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at catskillspropertycare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. and from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Cooler today than yesterday, high 51 with some sun and clouds mixed. Clear tonight and a low of 31. Mainly sunny tomorrow and a high of 53. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.